Thanks very much for that kind introduction. So, as Barry said, I'm going to talk about bank funding and capital flows in terms of what's been going on over the last few years. So, as you all know, the financial crisis has led to a significant reassessment of risk. Having been underpriced for a number of years prior to 2007, risk was rapidly and substantially repriced as the financial crisis unfolded. Counterparty risk came to the fore, and there has also been a more fundamental reassessment of the importance of liquidity risk. There is a newfound, or at least a refound, appreciation for the complex ways in which risk can affect the broader financial system. So given the pivotal role of banks in the financial system, the evolution of the financial crisis has placed particular focus on them and the way they fund themselves. Because one of the main features of banking is maturity transformation, banks were exposed to the realisation of a liquidity shock. Problems associated with liquidity, or more precisely, the lack of liquidity, proved to be an important channel for shocks in one part of the financial system to be propagated to others. The reassessment and the repricing of these risks have caused changes in the structure of funding of the Australian banks. So today I will discuss these developments on the liability side of banks' balance sheets, but at the same time, there have also been changes on the asset side of their balance sheets, with credit growth slowing significantly and particularly lending to large businesses. The combination of these changes, together with the investment-focused growth of the Australian economy at the moment, has had a marked effect on the composition of capital flows, which I'll discuss later in my talk. So let me start first on the bank funding side. So the repricing of risk significantly increased the cost of wholesale funding to the global banking system. At the shorter end of the yield curve, the rise in costs primarily reflected counterparty concerns. And this is best exemplified by this graph, which shows you the difference between a short-term rate in the interbank market and the expected policy rate. And it serves as a pretty useful summary of the way the crisis unfolded over the past 3 years. So I show you the yellow lines for Australia, the pink lines in the euro area, and then the US dollar rate. So in Australia, this spread never rose as much as it did in other countries, reflecting a general absence of counterparty concerns and the associated smoother functioning of the interbank market in Australia throughout most of the crisis. As the graph shows, this spread has fallen back in Australia to be not far above its pre-crisis levels. So that's at the front end of the yield curve. If I turn to the longer end of the yield curve, this shows you the spread for a bank issuing a three to five-year maturity bond against the equivalent government security. So at the longer term, the effect of this repricing of risk is much more stark, and pricing has clearly eased back from its peak, but it still remains well above its pre-crisis levels. The overall cost to a major Australian bank of issuing a three-year bond has risen to around 120 points over the government bond yield, compared with around 50 basis points pre-crisis. And as you can see on the graph, similar and larger changes have occurred in other banking sectors. In addition to this effect on the pricing of wholesale funding, the reassessment of risk has had a marked impact on the structure of banks' funding. So what I'm showing you here is the changed composition of the funding of the Australian banking system over the last decade or so. So the top light blue line is the share of funding from deposits. The orange red line is short-term wholesale funding. And then long-term wholesale funding, equity funding, and then the pink line, securitisation. So banks, their regulators and markets have reassessed the riskiness of different sources of funding, particularly liquidity risk and the related concept of rollover risk. So this change in perspective is embodied in the new Basel standards for the banking system, which are going to be announced, the final version of which at least is going to be announced shortly. So one notable change, as you can see here, is the rise in share of deposits from less than 40% in 2007 to over 45% currently. The desire to increase the share of deposits reflects the assumption, at least, that deposits represent a more stable source of funding than other sources. In order to boost their share of deposit funding, banks in Australia have competed aggressively in terms of price. An indication of the degree of competition for deposits is the extent to which there has been an increase in the cost of deposit funding relative to the cash rate that we set since mid-2008. So over that period, the average cost of the bank of a new deposit for a major bank, currently it's now only slightly below the cash rate, whereas 2 years ago it was about 150 basis points below. So the cost of deposit funding has gone up about 150 basis points relative to the cash rate. Competition has been strongest for term deposits. So let me just show you, which is the green line here. So you can see there that the on a new deposit used to be well below the pink line, the cash rate, now it's almost the same. Term deposits, the repricing has been at least as stark. So the average rate on a bank's term deposit is currently more than 70 points above market rates for a debt of equivalent terms. So if you think about it, wholesale debt is a tradable liquid instrument. A deposit is not a tradable instrument. So notwithstanding the fact that one's tradable and the other's not, the non-tradable instrument is pricing through the tradable instrument, which is interesting. So the bottom line of all of this is that the deposit market has been extremely competitive. The most marked increase in competition occurred late last year in Australia and the early part of this year. Since then, from what we can work out from our liaison, competitive pressures have not intensified any further, but nevertheless they remain at a high level. So at the same time as banks have increased their share of deposit funding by around 7 percentage points, the share of longer-term wholesale funding has also increased by a similar amount. Do you remember we're talking about shares here? So increasing two shares by about 7 percentage points in a couple of years is a pretty major change. The offset of those two increases is that the share of short-term funding has fallen by about 10 percentage points over the past 3 years, which is a particularly large change. As a result of these changes, the vulnerability of the Australian banking system to any further seizures in global financial markets has certainly decreased. But these changes have increased the cost of funding for the banking system as a whole. So if you think about it, as I mentioned earlier, the cost of all forms of funding have risen, and at the same time, banks have shifted to the more expensive sources of funding. So this shift has reflected market and regulatory pressures following that reassessment of risk. The financial crisis also raised awareness of other sources of risk for the global banking sector, some of which persist still. So for a number of European banks in particular, the currency and maturity mismatch between their assets and liabilities raised significant issues throughout the crisis, and it continues to be a vulnerability today. The fact that this issue is ongoing has been reflected in the recent rise in the euro-US dollar cross-currency basis swap over the past month or so, as concerns about Ireland have increased again. In contrast to the European banks, the Australian banks hedged the currency risk of their offshore borrowing using instruments that were maturity matched. The European banks, by contrast, borrowed short to invest, or they borrowed short in US dollars to hold very, very long-dated US dollar asset positions, and I use the word asset somewhat liberally here, as some of them haven't turned out to be that much of an asset. As a result of this, what the Australian banks did, they did not face the issue that some European banks faced of funding their US dollar assets from a euro funding base. So the US dollar swap lines that were instituted back in 2008 that a number of central banks, including the RBA, established with the Fed, were established in large part to alleviate these stresses stemming from the European banking system. As their funding was being severely curtailed from other sources, particularly from the US money markets, the European banks turned to the swap market to fund their long-dated and illiquid US dollar asset positions. The demand from European banks for US dollars each day, at the same time as supply was being reduced, caused the price of US dollars to rise dramatically in all markets and all time zones. So the RBA participated in the swap line with the Fed to help distribute US dollars into this time zone, into the Asian time zone. And the Bank of Japan's participation served a similar purpose. It did not reflect any issue with the Australian banking system's own need for the US dollars. The funds provided under the swap line were cheaper than the extremely wide market price at the time. And as a result, Australian-based banks availed themselves of this and in a number of cases on-lent the funds to banks in other jurisdictions who were particularly desperate for US dollars. The provision of these funds globally alleviated the strains in the swap market and the spread declined, and as I said just recently, has risen in the euro-US dollar swap. Once it declined below the price of the swap line, demand in Australia dried up and the facility was no longer offered here from around the first quarter of 2009, although it continued to attract demand for a longer period of time in other markets, and indeed the swap lines are still functioning in the euro area. So while these developments have been taking place on the liability side of banks' balance sheets, there's also been some interesting developments on the asset side too. So since 2008, there's been a marked easing in the pace of credit growth, particularly for the business sector. And if I disaggregate the slowdown in business credit growth further, which is what I've done in this graph between large firms and small firms, you can see that the easing in credit growth has been most striking for large businesses. So in fact, the behaviour of business credit here is actually not that dissimilar to what's going on in Europe or the US, notwithstanding the markedly different growth performance here versus what's going on in those other countries. And so what's going on in Australia reflects a number of factors. Firstly, some businesses have found it more cost-effective to access funds directly from the market rather than through the banking system. Secondly, in 2009 in Australia, there was a record level of equity raisings by large businesses that enabled them to repay debt. Thirdly, there has been a tightening in lending standards for some sectors, most notably in commercial property. And fourthly, a number of large businesses, particularly in the mining sector, have been able to fund their activities and repay debt from their retained earnings resulting from their strong cash flow. And I think that last factor, what's going on in the mining sector, has got a lot to do with what you see in that picture there. Looking forward, given the expected prominence of resource investment for GDP growth, it is quite possible this pattern of subdued business credit relative to robust growth in the economy might persist. So our forecasts have investment increasing as a share of the economy in the period ahead to historical highs. So investment as a share of GDP in Australia is likely to be as high as it's ever been in the country's history. Much, although not all, of this pickup in investment is in the resources sector. Companies undertaking that investment tend to be much less reliant on credit intermediated through the domestic banking system. Instead, they are likely to fund a sizable share of this investment from global capital markets, either through direct raisings or through syndicated loans. So this slowdown in growth on the asset side of banks' balance sheets has alleviated pressure on banks to increase their funding. So if I show you what's been going on, this is a sort of dirty summary of the asset and liability side of the bank's balance sheet. So credit growth is the growth in the asset side of the balance sheet, and then roughly the great broad money growth is growth in the liability side of the bank's balance sheet. You can see that over the last few years, credit growth has been slower than the growth in deposits for the first time in Australia since the early 1990s. So as mentioned, part of the explanation for the strong growth in deposits is the increased competition for deposits in the banking system. But another part of the explanation reflects the changed nature of the financial flows in the economy. So as I showed you, the parts of the corporate sector are less reliant on the domestic banking system for their funding. Ultimately, a large part of the funding that those guys raise, either in the form of cash flow or from other sources, still finds its way into the domestic banking system in the form of corporate deposits. So if the economy evolves as we forecast it to, it's quite possible this pattern of deposit growth outstripping credit growth continues, and deposits may continue to rise as a share of bank funding. So to some extent, you can think about the rise in deposit growth that we've seen, or deposit share of funding that we've seen to date, has been a sort of an exogenous decision by the banks to increase their deposit funding. But from here on in, they may actually experience an endogenous increase in deposit funding just because of the nature of financial flows in the economy. So these changes in bank funding, as well as in the funding of the increase in investment, are apparent in the financial account side of the balance of payments. These are the capital inflows that are counterpart of the current account deficit in Australia. So the net capital inflow into Australia masks very large gross capital inflows both into and out of the country. Given the size of these gross flows, it is misleading to analyse shifts in capital flows or how the current account is funded by focusing on net flows only. That doesn't stop a lot of people doing it that way. For a number of years prior to 2007, Australian banks were a steady source of capital inflow, representing around 4% of GDP or around 80% of net private sector inflow into the country. These capital inflows reflected the fact that Australian banks found it cost-effective to raise wholesale funds offshore to fund domestic asset growth. That these net flows into the banking system were similar in size to the current account, in my opinion at least, was as much coincidence as causation. Given the changes to bank funding and the slowdown in credit growth that you can see here, financial flows in the form of offshore debt raisings by Australian financial institutions have declined. So what I've got here is net private inflows, capital inflows into the country, despite just saying that you should focus on gross rather than net. In this part of the accounts, it doesn't make much difference. But anyhow, the yellow line is the net inflows, or the positive here is an inflow into the Australian banking system. So it's Australian banks raising funding offshore. Negative is that they've repaid debt offshore. So you can see here in the first three quarters of, you can see in the last quarter of 2008, the volatility in financial flows there as wholesale markets froze up. But but outside that period, now that we're back in a somewhat more less volatile period, in the first three quarters of 2010, the net inflow of foreign funding to the banking system was only 1% of GDP. In fact, all of that occurred in the first quarter of this year. In the last two quarters, the net amount of offshore funding by the banking sector in Australia amounts to zero. At the same time, the current account deficit has fallen to around 2.5% of GDP, but nevertheless, it is still a current account. So to those who believe that the banks fund the current account, they haven't been doing so for about the last three quarters. Going forward, the forecast rise in the investment share of the economy is likely to see an increase in capital inflows. As I discussed earlier, given that mining companies are likely to rely less on locally intermediated debt to fund their activities, there are likely to be further changes in the composition of net private capital inflows away from the banking sector and towards the non-financial corporate sector. Some of this might be in the form of increased direct debt raisings, some might be in the form of increase in retained earnings. So that while the current account may increase from its current level as the investment share of the economy rises, on the capital account side, there may not be a similar increase in banks' net offshore raisings. So let me conclude. The financial crisis has had a marked impact on financial flows globally. In this speech, I've described some of the effects it has had on financial flows in the Australian economy. The funding of the Australian banking system has changed quite markedly as it shifted towards more deposit funding, more long-term wholesale funding, and away from short-term wholesale funding. The cost of that funding has also similarly increased quite significantly. In addition, the forecast composition of growth in the Australian economy, at least our forecast of the growth in the Australian economy, and the funding of that growth may have implications for the asset side of the banking system's balance sheet. So I think it is quite possible that intermediated credit growth, i.e. credit growth going through the banking system, will be slower than it has been, particularly given the level of growth that we're looking at, and deposit growth relatively higher than has been the case for a number of decades in this country. These changes have been and are likely to continue to be reflected in the changed composition of the capital inflows into the country. So let me finish there, and I'm happy to take any questions that people might have. So if you can just put up your hand, and then I think there's some guys with microphones who will stick it under your mouth. No? Yes, sorry, desk down, sort of the back in the middle.
Hi, thank you for the presentation. I have a question. How likely do you assess the repeat of the scenario when Westpac in the past had to be rescued by Packer because of exposure to key corporate risks such as PepsiCo, which went bankrupt? And why do you say it's, what are your thoughts on this?
Thanks. You're talking about Westpac in the early 1990s, I assume. But
yes.
If you look at what's happened, I wouldn't say it was rescued by Packer, but anyhow, Westpac actually did survive on its own two feet. The difference in the late 80s, there was obviously a very rapid growth in corporate lending, and that was basically what caused the problems for the Australian banking system, including the foreign banks in Australia in the early 90s, as that sort of asset price boom unwound. And to some extent, and a colleague of mine, Lucy Ellis, has talked about this a fair bit, when banking systems get themselves in really serious trouble, it's normally associated with commercial property. So the US has managed to do a decent job of getting themselves in trouble just on the housing side of thing, but they've also had a fair chunk of their problems have also been on the commercial property side there too. If you look at the problems in Ireland, it's primarily commercial property. In Spain, it's a bit of a combination of the two, but if you look at the situation in Australia this time around, the bank's increase in problem loans has been in commercial property, but it's a much smaller share of their balance sheet than it was, say, back in the late 80s. So I think that experience, to some extent, that experience has caused the reassessment of the way that banks manage their risk, which has, I think, enabled them to come through this episode in a much stronger position. So, some of those lessons are sometimes forgotten, but in this case, at least in Australia, those lessons have been remembered, and so banks have managed their balance sheets a lot more conservatively through this episode than they did in earlier episodes, at least in Australia. That's obviously not true globally. So, down the front. While you're on the way through, but So this is the bank's need for wholesale funding. So I said, it's not on the demand side. There's actually, and you can actually see that in the sense. So I mean, there is an identification problem here, obviously. But I've got a price which I showed you earlier. But also from the information, from talking to people on the buy side in both Europe and the US, they have a healthy appetite for Australian bank paper. So it's not that they don't want to buy Australian bank paper, they actually do, and that's reflected in the fact that the price is still coming down because relative, if you want to have exposure to financial institutions globally, there's not a lot of safe alternatives outside the Australian banking system at the moment, or at least attractive alternatives. No, it reflects the fact that I was talking about is that the asset side of the growth of the balance sheet has slowed. So the need for funding has decreased. So that's one factor on the supply side. And the deposit growth has... I mean, if you think back 12 months, what the banks would have been forecasting would have been, my guess is, higher asset growth and slower deposit growth. And they've got... So that the fact that they've got slower credit growth but higher deposit growth has meant that the need to access offshore funding has decreased. So I would say it's mostly reflecting that change in funding needs rather than... I certainly don't think there's any issue on the demand side. Right. The same question. Okay. Yep. So we spent about 2 hours answering questions at the Senate on this on Monday. So I don't have a hell of a lot to add to... I got asked that question about 20 times. So... I don't have anything to add beyond what we said 2 days ago, and it's not our position to justify anything or not. We provided the so I would direct you to our submission to that Senate inquiry and to our answers we gave at that Senate inquiry as to what the facts are, and I'll leave it up to you to decide whether this is a market where people said the prices are set in the market on both sides, so it's up to you to work out whether that's appropriate or not. But as I said, I've answered that question innumerable times over the last couple of days, so I'm not going to answer it again. Or not going to don't have anything to further to add, sorry, to what was said a couple of days ago. Yeah.
Quick question. Do you see, with the drop in demand by corporates for bank lending, do you see banks becoming too exposed to residential mortgages in the Australian market?
Yeah, I mean that's a good question. I think so. If you look at it now, in terms of the on the asset side, it's getting close to 60% mortgages, 40% corporate lending. And if what I'm saying is going to come true, then that's probably going to shift even more in the direction of that. From a risk perspective, obviously, historically, the arrears rates on mortgages in Australia have been extraordinarily low and remain so today. That's reflected in the Basel risk weights as well. I'm not sure how you can. I don't think it's a difficult question to say that one is too exposed to an asset class. If I look at a building society or something like that, then they are. And I'm not saying the Australian banks are going to turn into building societies, but for a building society or a credit union or they have a much higher share of home lending in their asset portfolio. Doesn't generally, or hasn't historically, caused them a lot of issues. But it is an interesting question to think about. And if you think about the banks looking for sort of balanced asset growth going forward, it is an interesting question to think of if they're not going to be getting that lending to the sort of large corporates. What exactly their response is going to be? So. To some extent, I think that is going to be the interesting question to see what the answer is to that over the next few years. I said, if things turn out the way I think they might.
Historically, the interest rates, the mortgage interest rates in Australia are above the average, we told other comparable developing countries. My question is with regards to what extent the main bank is supportive for further competition and fairness in the mortgage rates market and supportive also to more transparent way of really
More transparency about what, sorry?
Transparency in the way the four main banks are really acting in the last several.
Well, I mean, it's fairly transparent. They've increased, you know, they announced when they increased their mortgage rates. But I mean, we answered this question extensively on Monday. But as the governor said on Monday, the mortgage rate is about where we want it. If it wasn't, we would adjust our policy rate to ensure that it was. We take into account what the banks do, and it's not just the large banks, it's all banks do with their mortgage rates in our setting of policy. So the price of credit, the price of housing credit is about where we want it, and I said if it wasn't, we would do something about it. So in terms of the price, as I said, that's sort of where that is. I said Glenn answered a number of questions about competition. The market is, I think my colleagues at the Treasury said, the mortgage market is certainly contestable. Beyond that, I suppose I don't have a hell of a lot to add to it, what we said on Monday. One more down there.
The Treasurer has recently expressed concern about price signalling. Could you define what you understand by this, and do you share these concerns?
I think you best ask that question to. Well, we can ask that question to Ken Henry when he speaks shortly. But I think price signalling is not something for us. It's something for the ACCC or the Treasurer.
In perspective, with the Eurozone and challenges that they've been facing. Hmm. Now we are seeing that some smaller countries within Eurozone, they are encouraging their banks to raise deposit rate as a way of attracting more capital, if you like, within the Eurozone. What will be the implication of such policy in Europe on wholesale funding and international capital market if other banks around the world start competing, if you like, for deposits of consumers?
I think the competition is more in the wholesale market rather than the competition for deposits tends to be a local issue, Iceland being one exception, but it's clearly a route which people aren't going to follow in the future. But I mean, there is the issue, if put it in economic terms, of adverse selection. So when people, and this was particularly evident in 2008, the banks who were bidding the most aggressively for deposits in terms of higher rates tended not to get the flows because everyone was concerned about why they were bidding aggressively with higher rates. So, increasing your deposit rate well beyond what your competitors are doing tends to generate a lot of adverse selection. On the wholesale side of things, I think what is going to be interesting is I think there's a reasonable chance there's going to be a fair amount of tiering in the bank, in the wholesale debt market in the banking system next year. There's a fair amount of debt which needs to be refinanced, particularly government-guaranteed debt of the European banking system. And it's become reasonably apparent that there are strong banks and there are not so strong banks in the euro area. My guess is that the strong banks globally, and I would include the Australian banks in that, are going to find that investors who want to hold some exposure to bank credit are going to reallocate their portfolios towards them. And the weaker banks, I think, are going to have trouble. And price is potentially not going to solve that. Ultimately, there's some price which will probably solve that, but it might be a price which makes the business model of the bank who's on the receiving end of the high price not particularly sustainable. So I think that will be quite interesting. As I said, I think if you're a strong bank, my guess is you're probably not going to have a lot of trouble next year. If you're a not so strong bank, you may have a decent amount of trouble just because of the vast volume of refinancing which needs to take place over the next 12 months. Okay.
I think it has implications for the non-banks, or not non-banks, but the weaker banks and the other ADIs, and the question of competitiveness, therefore, between the four majors and the others, that gap is going to become greater rather than less, as far as I can see, and it's also reinforced by the new Basel rules.
That last statement is not true at all. If anything, as John Laker said at the Senate inquiry yesterday, the new Basel rules make it more costly for the larger institutions than it does the smaller institutions. It also, If I didn't show you, I can show you, if you look at where deposit flows have been going, the smaller banks have actually been attracting a disproportionate share of deposit flow. So that share of, that has allowed them to expand their balance sheet. The government's program of purchasing mortgage-backed securities through the AOFM is also one which is allows the smaller institutions capacity to expand lending, which is not available to the larger institutions, so to the larger banks. And I said this at a speech 2 weeks ago, I actually think the securitisation market is coming back in Australia, which this again is to is going to be more to the benefit of the smaller institutions than the larger institutions. So I think there are a number of I don't think the funding issues I was talking about, I think, are going to be much more obvious in Europe than they are here. The smaller banks here don't access the wholesale market anyhow, so that's not really an issue through them. The only issue for them, the only way they tap the global market is tends to be through mortgage-backed securities, and I think there is some sign that that market may actually be stronger, barring any global setbacks. It's going to be stronger next year than it was this year, just as it was stronger this year than it was the previous year.
Thank you.